Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours. In store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551 text number. Remember, this coming Thursday, we are in the Landmark Hotel in the centre of Carrick and Shannon for Funny Friday, if you follow me, on this coming Thursday. All the usual crew, loads of giveaways, loads of fun, and I'm completely free, and the doors open at midday. You're very welcome. Bevan Jones. Bevan, good afternoon. It's Carrick and Shannon I'm talking about, but you're giving out about Dublin, the place you love so well. And what, your bag was robbed twice.
Yeah, hi Joe. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it. You do a great thing for the community. I'm from Dublin, born and bred, you know, in the sense of, you know, from dock workers, seamstresses, you name it, you know. So I've always been so proud of our city. In the last month, I've been robbed twice, once on the Lewis and once on Drury Street.
Okay, Drury Street in the centre of Dublin. Okay, tell us the Lewis story first.
So I was heading in with my mum to go to a concert, and between George's Dock and the Point.
Yeah.
And it was packed, as you can imagine. I'm always conscious of my stuff on me, and I'm aware pickpocketing happens. But in a split second where I wasn't paying attention, it was gone. And people around were trying to help. When I got off at the Point, there was a guard there because of the concert. I was able to report it. That's under investigation at the moment.
And what was stolen?
So there was my wallet had all cash in it, my driving license, my bank card, gift vouchers that I know the people that got them for me, they weren't easily come by. You know, they were gifts that people had. And that kind of impacted me a lot in that sense, because people had given it out of the goodness, and here it was, someone just took it. So I'm really grateful. They were for Ernest Dunn Stores, and they were able to track them down, investigate them. Yeah, they did a great job because it was a theft, and that's what I loved. It was like, you're in a tough time, we're going to help you out. We're not just going to say no, right?
Done.
So then Saturday I'm going into the city centre again to say, right, I'm going to use these vouchers, stop putting off getting something.
Yeah.
Split second, I mean, I'd been around town, I was sitting outside, it was the one time I let my guard down, having something to eat, I had a crossbody zipped up bag, you know, I'd tested it even before going out, going, yeah, this, I'll be okay with this. And yeah, got stolen again.
How? You had a crossbody bag. What does that mean? You had it across your body, or you had it strapped over your shoulders?
I had it across the front of me, like a cross shoulder one.
Yeah.
A small one, you know, the ones that you just hold your phone in. And within that, so a couple of pockets. So obviously while I was eating, it might have been down more by my side rather than the front when I'd been walking around. And yeah, and it took no time, it seems, that they were able to, without me noticing.
So they managed to unzip a bag that was wrapped around your shoulder, so to speak, but maybe to the side. They managed to unzip the bag and dip the wallet.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And nobody spotted anything, or obviously.
No. Now, obviously, the Gardaí will request the CCTV.
Yeah.
I followed up again on the vouchers, because initially part of my hope was if they tried to spend it, they could be caught on CCTV spending it, and you know, to make the case. But I think it's just shocking how bad it is in the city, because I've, you know, lots of feedback from other people, you know, people who would have gone into town, you know, meet up and have their coffees, you know, older people. And they're too fearful to go in now. I know people in the city centre who say O'Connell Bridge, North Earl Street, Talbot Street are no-go areas at the night time. There's not enough guards around. And just, like, you see guys with, you know, balaclavas walking around. Even when I was reporting into the Garda station to get my driving license signed, a guy walks in with his ski mask on, you know. And I felt intimidated in the Garda station. So I just think there is a lack of control that I think is tied into, one, the judicial system on how people aren't, you know, penalised. I've stopped saying pickpocketed because I'm saying robbed, because I think pickpocket kind of demeans the experience of people. It's like almost becomes a victim blaming, like, oh, well, you should have had it better. You know, you should have. What were you doing with that? You
know, hang on, you had your bag strapped across your shoulder. What more do you want? What more do people? And what time of day was the Drury Street incident? Drury Street, which is off South Great Georgia Street in Dublin. What day was the Drury Street incident?
That was Saturday about 5 o'clock.
Oh, for God's sake. CCTV? Still day, still daylight, that's my point. CCTV?
So that's there's a Pulse case opened for that to be investigated. Obviously, I can't request that CCTV. I know in the first incident, the Lewis confirmed that they could provide the CCTV to the
To the Gardaí. We were covering shoplifting on the programme here last week. About Dublin and outside of two developments there. One, I see that Pennies, where they were trialling it for a few weeks, Pennies are, when you go up to the checkout in Pennies and you purchase, once you purchase, they now seal your bag with a big sticker the size of a beer coaster. They close the top of the bag, and apparently this is to try and reduce the 2 billion a year that is shoplifted in Ireland. 2 billion. And that's on the Pennies situation, trying to reduce shoplifting. And as I say, it's two billion a year. So, I mean, there's a lot of robbing going on, And then you mentioned the CCTV. There's a piece in the newspaper, one of the papers this morning, I'll try and grab it, where security staff in shops in Dublin saying they're not allowed share the CCTV of these thieves, even among themselves. They have to wait for the Gardaí to come, and it's because of GDPR regulations. Are you optimistic, Bevan, about getting any of this stuff back?
I'm not. And look, that's okay. For me, I think it's more about the awareness. You know, because people live in the city as well.
Yeah, and love the city centre.
And it's just so disappointing what's happening, and promises, I think, that were made aren't really in place. You know, I had friends, had people coming over from the US, and they were saying, oh, where can I go listen to trad music? And they were going to recommend a place on Talbot Street. And it was like, no, that's a no-go. You wouldn't. And that's impacted
not, but anyway,
businesses.
Yeah.
But it's impacting businesses. Yeah. It's not a no-go.
Of course it is. Yeah, I know. People's perception sometimes. Okay, and are you from, because I was doing a piece with Nationwide there the other day about O'Connell Street and the history of, and 100 years since, and I was making the point that there's no other street and no other capital and no other country in the world that contains so much of our history. The state was essentially founded on... in 1916, on O'Connell Street. Every major event in the country went up, down, across and through O'Connell Street. So it's a really historic city centre, as you know. Are you from the city centre, Bevan?
Yeah, well, we moved out when I was younger, but I'm back in the city centre. I loved it too much. I was always a blow-in when we moved out. I can tell you, 1917, my great-grandfather went down in the SS Adela. It was torpedoed, a merchant navy between Dublin and Liverpool.
The SS, you know, what?
The SS? SS Adela.
Adela, okay. So that was World War One.
Yeah, 1917.
And who was lost on that? Your grandfather?
My great-grandfather.
Wow. Okay.
And... you know, my other grandfather worked in Boland's Mill, community really rallied around him. You know, it's so all of that is from, all my family is from the centre of the city, and I've always loved it. And I love the sense of community, like even in the city where I'm living now, you know, my neighbours have the keys. It's like open presses, that old school mentality, you know, if you're shorthand and you just come in, I give it to you, there's no questions asked. You know, that's the real Dublin, not what we're seeing at the moment, you know.
And I can tell you, I went into the Stardust inquest there the other morning, which is a remarkable remarkable achievement for the relatives, and it's remarkably well well organised and well arranged, and the staff are just so wonderful, especially to the families, so wonderful to the family. But that's neither here nor there. But I was walking up Parnell Street at about 10 o'clock on a Friday morning, and it could have been a Dublin street at 10 o'clock on a Friday night. It was so busy. So busy with groups of young men. I'm sure they all had positive intent. Groups of young men rambling up and down the street. That was at 10 o'clock in the morning. Dublin is a busy place. And it's a busy place with a lot of young men. And O'Connell Street, O'Connell Street is very busy with, again, young men. I know there's the coffee shops and all that carry on, but it's a very, very busy spot now. All day, every day. Stay with us, Bevan, for a second. Brian Coleman. Brian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good, thanks. I mentioned earlier on, and there's a heave on in Fine Gael, so to speak, against the hate crime bill, but there's also a heave on against this plan to extend the opening hours of pubs to 12:30 normally instead of 11:30 every night, 2:30 at the weekends if they wish, and nightclubs can stay open under the new proposed legislation, Department of Justice, they can stay open till 6 o'clock in the morning. But you say where you're living, you're mitred.
We are indeed, Joe. Just in reference to the lady just talking there before,
Bevan.
Bevan. We're fourth generation people living in Camden Place.
Okay.
Again, it has historical influence as regards the 1916 Rising. My dad was a great international boxer. He won the European Heavyweight Championship for. In 1947, he boxed for Ireland in the Olympic Games in London in 1948.
Okay.
So we're the last, his name was Garota Coleman, we're the last residents living in the in Camden Place. And we see, we get impacted heavily by the amount of antisocial behaviour, violence, all geared up towards this new late night culture. As I emailed one of the producers, I said the 3C cultures, it's coffee, cocktails and cocaine.
Wow.
And the streets here, there's such a volume of such an amount of late night premises on Camden Street at the moment. Between now the corner her of Camden Place and Montague, there's seven late night venues at the moment. Now, existing wise, I know the official closing time is whatever time it is now, but
11:30.
Like but some nights is non-existent. They stay open till 2-3.
Yeah, but somebody. But in those cases, you have to apply for a special license. But the proposal is that you wouldn't have to apply for a special license to stay open, for example, to 12:30. So every pub can stay open till anywhere they're selling nightclubs or whatever. But a lot of nightclubs don't open till 12:30, and then nightclubs would be able to stay open till 6 a.m. What do you think of that?
Yeah, terrible. Because the amount of the amount of places on Camden Street that sell alcohol, there's many pubs, and pubs down Wexford Street, further up Camden Street, all the restaurants serve alcohol, the supermarkets. So people on the street here, like at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, like they're coming out of the pubs, they're coming up here. Like if the new legislation comes in, they're going to a nightclub till 6 a.m. in the morning, and then they're coming out. Like, it causes massive antisocial, drugs, sleep deprivation for myself and the family, anxiety, stress. Like, it's uncanny the amount of people that exist up here at the weekend.
And if any of the pubs or the nightclubs got signs up outside saying, please remember, you're in the heart of Dublin, you're in a residential area, please be conscious of our neighbours.
Well, one has. I think the only place I can see is one place has. Like, a lot of them, I don't know how they're actually allowed, the amount of people that they have. Like, if a fire ever happened to any of them, like, it could be that they're massively overloaded. A lot of them have now, I notice, a good few of them have had smoking areas, which are now beer gardens with music. You know,
and what do you think of this? What do you think of this movement in Fine Gael against the proposal by the Department of Justice, by the Minister for Justice, to extend pub opening hours? And now I know there's the licensed vintners are in favour of as well. What would you think of that proposal?
Well, I wouldn't think very highly. I think of it's desperate because it means that the amount of people are going to be out. They're going to consume a lot more alcohol. There's going to be a lot more trouble. There's going to be a lot more people ill heading to the A&Es, to the hospitals, who are already overloaded. The Garda Síochána can't do anything because there's a volume of people up here. It's uncanny. And you never, ever see Gardaí up here at night time. Except now, as I said to your producer earlier on, at Patrick's weekend, we had the rugby match on Saturday, Patrick's Day on the Sunday. And myself, my wife, we were in total fear of the amount of people that were up here on Saturday and Sunday. On Sunday, on Patrick's Day, we went into town to ramble around, came back up, went across to our local pub here, sat outside, and the amount of people that were there, but I have to admit, which was great, there was a guard presence.
Okay, good.
And the guards are very professional in dealing with people who are troublemakers. They observed everything. They gave a presence on the street that you could see.
Okay.
But just to finish off, Joe, I had been actually on to the Minister for Justice last year about this what was developing on Camden Street. But I emailed her on the day after Patrick's Day on the Tuesday, and just to thank her for actually having police on the street. And I contacted the Gardaí in Pierce Street, the community guard inspector. I left a message for him and thanked him. But these extended opening hours, it'd be catastrophic. Especially if I know the people, these nightclub owners and all are saying, oh, our vintners and all this. But there's such an amount of them.
Okay, that point is well made. But just to remind people, this law is coming down the tracks, and these bar, they're not extensions, because extensions are normally individual applications. These are new laws, and you won't need an application. You won't need to go up and spend money in the courts to get your application. And you remember, for your late night drinking, and remember, that's the excuse a lot of pubs use for charging €10 for a pint of Hino, because they have to pay for the late night openings. But under the new proposals by the Justice Minister, the government has promised late night pub and club openings, operation by, it's supposed to be last summer, but they said now it'll be this summer, which is not too far away. Nightclubs will open until 6 a.m. Pubs will open until 12:30 a.m. And they're too normal. In other words, you won't need to apply to stay open to those hours. And then there will be proposals to allow some pubs open till 2:30 in the morning. Do you think, as I think, who was it, Michael Ring and I think Charlie Flanagan are saying, Bennett. Okay, Helen Walsh, what happened Thursday afternoon, the Lewis line in Dublin? Which Lewis line, the red or the green?
The red.
The red goes to Talla.
And the point goes
from Talla to the point, in fairness.
That's right, Joe.
Yeah.
I was on the Lewis, I got on at Jervis Street with my friend Noreen.
Okay.
And it was jammers, absolutely packed. We were standing up inside the door. I was holding on to the railing because I had a problem with my leg. Anyway, chatting away, and this person was beside us, beside me anyway. And I saw them looking at me once or twice. And I thought, Jesus, I hope they don't think I'm trying to pickpocket them.
Okay.
But anyway, we got as far as the market there, Smithfield.
Smithfield, yeah.
And a lot of people got out. Mm-hmm. But this person that was on the loose beside me looked at us a few times, very strangely.
Okay.
And my friend Noreen and I looked at one another because, when someone is looking at you funny.
Well, what male, female, what gender?
Or a man. Right. I wasn't sure for a while whether it was male or female because they had a cap on. A hat
age
on.
Age group?
Oh, 30-ish, in their 30s maybe, okay. Youngish anyway.
Okay.
I could only really see the side of their face because it was so packed. And they looked at me once or twice and looked at Noreen, and I looked at Noreen and she looked at me and we thought, strange look. Mm. Anyway, thought no more of it. Next thing, they got out, at the crowd got out at Smithfield. My friend said to me, there's the seat, Helen. I went to sit down, and as I went to move, I said, oh my God, my purse is gone.
I forgot. And you realised so quickly.
Joe, I never even felt it. Didn't even notice it, even though I should have been a bit more aware, but I wasn't. So I sat down, and of course they were gone. Noreen said to me, it was him. It was definitely him.
Okay, where
so
was
I reported
he?
It.
And where was he gone?
Off, got off the loose, straight. Big crowd got off at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was split second, and I missed my purse, Joe. As I went to sit on the seat, I looked and I said, oh my God, my purse.
And where
is
was
gone.
Your purse that was managed
in
to be
in my
dipped?
Bag. I had my bag across wow. my shoulder in the front of me.
Yeah.
On my stomach, that way. That's the only way I can explain it. But
oh, they're getting very nifty.
That's why I was going to ring you then and I didn't. But I'm hearing more and more and more of it. Mm. I was out last night and I was at bingo and one of the women, Donna, she said to me, did you hear anything about your bag, Helen? I said, no. She said her niece was robbed the other day, yesterday, the day before. So obviously it's getting worse and worse.
And where was the niece? Where did...
I can't remember okay. whether she okay. said she was on the loose or not. Joe,
what,
or
was
in
your, what was in your bag, Helen?
Well, everything was in my bag.
Oh, for God's
my driving license, my card, my medical card, my bank cards.
Oh, for God's sake.
What else? Loads of things were in it, Joe, but all of the cards that I need.
Is there
I have to reapply for everything.
There is CCTV on the Lewis, isn't there? There is,
well,
isn't
there? Well, I did get on to them and they asked me,
yeah.
how did I describe the person? I said, really, not particularly. Only saw the side of the person's face. I told them where I was standing. And I had a very distinct scarf on, actually, a checkered scarf.
Okay.
And I said...
And do you report it, Helen, sorry, do you report it to the guards or to the Lewis?
Oh, I reported to everyone.
Oh, everyone. Good woman.
I had two guards here from Crumlin with me that
good
evening.
Woman. Yeah, okay.
So I'm just trying to... It just seems to be getting more and more prevalent. And I don't know if people are aware of it. Now, I never in my life felt... frightened on the loose ever
mm-hmm.
or uncomfortable, you know, nothing has ever happened to me on the
okay,
loose.
Okay, yeah, same here.
But now
yeah.
it seems to be going on all the time. And my friend who was with me was going on up to Kingswood, and she met the security guards, and they said we are tormented, but we can't catch them. I think what they do is they pass on the purse to someone else.
Yeah.
So I just want people to be aware of it if you're going in. Anywhere on the loose or anywhere
maybe,
like
yes.
that. But
and
it's just happening in town as well.
Yeah, but
it's
I'm very conscious that you were vigilant, Bevan was vigilant.
Yes. It's horrendous.
Yeah.
It's okay. awful, like.
And, it's,
and then they just throw away all your stuff,
yeah,
you know,
then
and then you have to go to all the trouble
exactly.
of getting all this back again.
Exactly. And off
yeah,
you go.
So
and,
I just want to warn people out there, just be extra careful going in or out of the loose into town.
Okay. Okay.
Be aware that it's going
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
Now, Joe, I did hear it going into town that morning. There was a warning, but I forgot about it because I'd
yeah.
never heard it before. But someone told me they do tell you. But I was thinking, the person beside me was thinking I was trying to rob them. They made me paranoid, and I think this is what they're doing.
And how did that feeling or sensation or belief come into your head, Helen? That they
because
thought...
Well, the way they were looking at me, and my hand was on the rail,
yeah,
so I moved my hand down because I was holding on, and then I moved it up again and said, oh, my God, I hope they don't think I'm trying to take something
okay.
out of their pocket.
Okay. Helen, hopefully now, on the car, we've been on to the Gardaí press office, and they say both Bevan's two thefts and yours are being... investigated. But as you say, it's a warning. Be extra vigilant. Be extra vigilant. Joe at rt.ie 51551 is the text number.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at rt.ie. I mentioned yesterday a major story which emerged last week in the Financial Times, as you know, based on all newspapers, but it's a brilliant, brilliant newspaper, incredible reputation. And it was a piece by, a long, long piece by a journalist called Antonia Cundy, and it's about Opus Dei. Now, anyone in Ireland knows that Opus Dei's existence. It's been here since 1947. They ran hostels. They're a Catholic organisation, as you know, a lay organisation. But the allegations made in this article come from three women, and one of them is Irish. And she's quoted in this article as saying she was... She applied for a job. She didn't know at the time. She saw when she was around 16. She applied for a job in a hospitality course, and it was a boarding course. And it's only when she got it that she realised she was working for, well, working is the wrong word because she wasn't being paid. She was working for Opus Dei. They didn't put Opus Dei in the ad. And her title was an assistant numerary. And basically, assistant numeraries in Opus Dei were domestic workers who weren't being paid, and they recruited young girls from rural working class backgrounds. And the premise was you'd receive an education, but the women are saying they were coerced by Opus Dei into domestic servitude, in effect, modern slavery. Now, one of the contributors to that program was Tina Fogarty. And Tina spoke on the Religious Affairs programme on BBC Radio 4 early on Sunday morning. It's called Sunday, actually, presented by Edward Stoughton. This is Tina Fogarty from Dublin talking about her experience when she answered this ad, which was misleading, to say the least, because it didn't mention Opus Dei. This is Tina Fogarty.
I was expecting a school because it did say hospitality and catering. So I imagined it would cover all aspects of learning about how to work in hospitality industry. I knew there was an emphasis on religion, but I didn't know there were an organization per se. We had prayers and mass first, and then we went cleaning, cooking, more cleaning, cooking, laundry. And we had to prepare three meals a day plus other snacks and things like that for up to 100 people. I remember having cracked and broken hands from the calluses and the welts. And the next day you start exactly the same, and it went on and on. Even after becoming an official member, I never received any payment at all. We got an allowance on request, £3 a month, for which you had to account for each penny and return any change that you might have had after buying your toiletries and your sanitary products. I knew there were numeraries and assistant numeraries, and I, in my naivety, thought that you could start as an assistant numerary and progress to numerary. They put me straight on that quite quickly when I questioned it. This is your vocation, and you can only be an assistant numerary, and your vocation is to serve.
Wow. That was Tina Fogarty. Antonia Cundy is on the line. Antonia, the journalist. Antonia, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And it's a clear line, which is great. Antonia, where is Ballyglunin Park?
Ballyglunin Park is in Galway.
Okay.
It is a large manor house that is no longer owned by Opus Dei,
right.
But it used to be run as a retreat centre for Opus Dei members to go on religious spiritual retreats, which they do for several weeks every year. And in the stable yards, the kind of old stable yard annex, and in the basements, that was where Opus Dei also ran a hospitality school for young girls. And that was a school like the one that Tina attended in Dublin.
Okay.
And another Irish woman attended at Ballyglunin Park, who I spoke to in the article.
And that's Anne-Marie Allen. And
that's Anne-Marie Allen, yeah.
She said she was 15 when she went to Ballyglunin. What did she think she was doing, Antonia?
So she, like all the other former assistant numeraries that I spoke to around the world, Anne-Marie and Tina in Ireland, they thought they were going to a catering college, a hospitality school. They were young girls, 15, 16, and they thought they would get qualifications to then work in the catering industry. And in some respects, in some cases, they even were told that they would have guaranteed employment afterwards. So, for example, I found the advert of the school that they went to, and one of the adverts is titled "Interesting Career." So, yeah, they were expecting an education, one in which, you know, their hobbies would be tended to, etc. And that was not what they got.
And, Antonia, was Opus Dei mentioned in the advert that you got your hands on?
No, not at all. It just says, you know, please write to the secretary, Ballaglunin Park, Ballabbott Catering School, which was the name that they gave the stable yard annexes. There's no mention of Opus Dei. There wasn't any mention of religious direction at all. Absolutely nothing.
And where was Cranton, where Tina went?
So Cranton,
Tina Fogarty.
Yeah, Cranton is a similar school in Dublin, which is attached to the back end of Nullarmore House, which is still owned and run by an Opus Dei affiliated charity today. That's a male student residence, Nullarmore House, but Cranton, which is attached to it, was a catering school. Today, it's no longer a catering school. It's just what's called the administration of an Opus Dei centre, which is the name for both the women who look after an Opus Dei centre and do the domestic work, as well as the actual area of the centre in which they live. But yeah, so Cranton was the equivalent to Ballaglunin, but just in Dublin.
But were these assistant numeraries, were they always female?
They're always female. The vocation of assistant numerary in Opus Dei is only available to women. And it's probably worth noting that in Opus Dei's statutes from 1950, not their statutes, but their other internal directives, the assistant numeraries didn't actually used to be called assistant numeraries. They were just called servants.
Wow. Which is what they were, unpaid in many cases, it seems. Well, a modest £3 a month, which you have to account for and hand back anything you couldn't account for. You say in your piece that the assistant numeraries were celibates, were expected to remain celibate, lived in Opus Dei centres, and they were to dedicate their lives to the manual work or domestic tasks in the centres of Opus Dei.
Yeah, exactly. So it might be helpful to give an overview of Opus Dei's other members. So the majority of members in Opus Dei are what's called supernumeraries, and they are married members, so they don't live in Opus Dei centres. They're allowed to have families, and they give a lot of money to Opus Dei, but they have their own living allowances and live in their own homes. About 25% of the organisation's members are celibates who live in Opus Dei centres. Those centres are strictly single sex. Men and women live in different centres. Apart from the fact that, so the people that live in those centres, the celibates, are mainly numeraries, which is the sort of typically more educated Opus Dei member. That numeraries are expected to have gone to university because they're expected to study theology to a high level. They will have secular jobs, you know, bankers, lawyers, clerks, whatever they like. And numeraries who live in Opus Dei centres, as well as supernumeraries who visit Opus Dei centres for retreats, they are looked after by assistant numeraries who are women and only women, whose vocation it is, who in some cases were coerced into believing it was their vocation to work as the domestic workers in an Opus Dei centre, so doing all the cooking, all the cleaning and all the laundry. And yes, as you say, today Opus Dei insists in the UK and Ireland that position is paid, and I've spoken to people who do say they are paid, but in the past there have been many cases where it was not.
Yeah, and there's another place, Lismullen Conference Centre in County Meath. They still are a big organisation in Ireland and indeed across the world, with their headquarters in Rome, and their founder was canonised, was he not, relatively quickly by the Pope. How did these issues come to your attention, Antonia?
So they came to my attention because Anne-Marie Allen, one of the women I spoke to who was an assistant numerary in Ireland, she actually got in touch with a colleague of mine at the newspaper that I work at, the FT. Okay. And he thought it was more my bag, so he passed it on to me. But when Anne-Marie got in touch, you know, the first thing you do is you sort of look up, mm-hmm. see if there's any other reporting on the subject. And in Argentina, the year before Anne-Marie got in touch with me, 43 women very publicly denounced Opus Dei in the Argentinian press and later brought a complaint against the Vatican, and that's currently being investigated by the Argentinian authorities. And they were saying the same thing, those women. They were saying that they went to hospitality schools under a false premise of an education. It turned out to be free labor for an Opus Dei center, and there they were convinced that they should join as assistant numeraries, and then they worked unpaid without even being registered in the social security system, and were not free to leave when they wanted to leave. And those cases, some of them are far more recent than the cases that have been uncovered in Ireland. So, you know, I've spoken to women in Latin America who left Opus Dei as recently as 2020 and weren't paid.
Which means that those women, and the stories are, they're parallels in Ireland with the mother and baby homes, because those women who worked in those places, just like in Opus Dei, I presume the likes of Tina Fogarty and Anne-Marie, Alan, I presume they have no pension, no payments, no health benefits if they were basically treated as unpaid servants.
Yeah, so it depends on case to case, but you're right, there was no health benefits. When they were taken to the doctor, they were accompanied by a numerary, one of these more senior members of Opus Dei. So they didn't even have autonomy over their own medical care. Many of them were prescribed antidepressants by doctors who were also members of Opus Dei. The pension contributions, it varies individual to individual. Some people were registered for very, very minimal social security contributions. Tina, in one case, she had social security contributions of £10 for 1 year. And some years were incomplete and missing. But that varies from case to case, but there are many people who had none whatsoever.
But Opus Dei, Antonia, are a very wealthy organisation, are they not?
Well, they
why
would say
do they
that
need,
they're not.
Why do they need? Well, in Ireland, they're regarded as being very, quite well off. Even in their property, they own Dublin 4, for example, city centre of Dublin, for example. What justification did they give, if any, for not paying these women? And you say at one stage there was 4,000 of them.
Yeah, so today there are 4,000 assistant numeraries all over the world. Opus Dei have said that, you know, the cases where the women weren't paid were errors. They have said that is down errors, yeah. And they've said that's the responsibility of the individual centres, because the trouble that particularly, you know, these victims have in getting accountability is that Opus Dei is not a company. It's not a legal entity. It's a religious organisation. And the centres, for example, the hospitality schools or the retreat centres or Dublin 4, as you mentioned, they are owned by charities or foundations or other actual legal entities that are set up typically by members. And so Opus Dei is able to say, and legally it's quite correct to say, that the responsibility for employment and the responsibility for, you know, ownership of assets, etc., is the responsibility of those charities, and it is decentralized, and it's not actually Opus Dei itself. So they have said, you know, that there were some clearly cases that were mishandled, or there were errors in particular centres, and that they want to investigate them on a case-by-case basis. But from my reporting, when you speak to, you know, a dozen women who had very similar experiences over a five-decade period across countries all over the world, it gives a very institutional appearance, and it seems like this is a consequence of an institutional atmosphere rather than irregularities in certain charities or by certain directors of certain centres.
And was it always the case that the likes of Tina Fogarty and Anne-Marie Allen, who were assistant numeraries, they were serving men?
They were serving men, yeah. Wow. So Opus Dei centres are, as I said, strictly sex, apart from the fact that the administration, which is what they call the women who care for the domestic work, i.e. the assistant numeraries, they are allowed to share but be separated from within the same building. A men's residence because they cater and do the domestic work, okay. cooking the cleaning for the men. And the men are not allowed to look at them, see them, not really meant to know their names. I spoke to an Opus Dei male member this year, and he said, you know, he might say hello, but he wouldn't ask how they are.
He wouldn't or couldn't?
He wouldn't. He said he would not ask how they are. That was the Opus Dei's press officer in the UK. And I've been in Opus Dei centres today, and when the assistant numeraries there, who do say they are paid, they when they came into the room, they sort of, it was very uncomfortable. This woman sort of scurried out of sight when the man came into the room. So there is still a very strong division, and all the men that live in that building would not know the individual names of the women who are, you know, cleaning their underwear.
Stay with us, Antonia, because this, I'm sure people listening, this is so many echoes of different events in Ireland, and it's an incredible job you've done in the last, well, it's a long while, given that the looking at the depth of your article, much you've uncovered. We're talking about Opus Dei, and we're talking about a position in Opus Dei that was called assistant numeraries. And apparently, with this, what year would, what decade would Tina and Anne-Marie have seen those ads in the newspapers for these 4-year education at the hospital? No mention of Opus Dei, of course. What, would that be the 60s or 70s or the 80s or the 50s, Antonia, do you know?
That they saw them in the 70s, the late 70s.
Okay.
But I found those adverts going into the 80s.
Okay, well, 1979, Pope John Paul II came to Ireland. That's how recent that is. Stay with us. Opus Dei, 51551 is our text number. joe@rte.ie and 51551, as I say. But 0818 715 815 if you want to contact us immediately.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
A lot of people in Ireland will be familiar, and a lot of people in Ireland are members, I'm sure, and have been members of their family. Invariably, their male family have been members of Opus Dei over the years. They have a number of properties here. They're very active. Their headquarters in Ireland are in Dalkey in Dublin and Cunningham Road in Dalkey. This is an article written by Antonia Cundy from the Financial Times, and it's based on the testimony of three women, two of whom are from Ireland, Anne-Marie Allen and Tina Fogarty. They've spoken about being, is the word duped, would that fit here, Antonia, that they were duped into applying to these Opus Dei institutions, because Opus Dei wasn't on the ad?
I think the application, was a duping, because it was not mentioned. But what happened to them afterwards was much stronger. It was coercion and arguably, you know, brainwashing and sort of love bombing recruitment tactics that you do see in cults and cult-like behaviour. But yes, to start with, it was definitely they did not have the full information about the catering colleges they were attending.
Okay, well, Opus Dei, this is from their website. Opus Dei is a Catholic institution working in more than 60 countries around the world. It has been in Ireland since 1947, and it involves mainly lay people, obviously they're chaplains or whatever attached to the organisation, who identify as Catholics, and they you can either say you're a member, you're not obliged, but you're not discouraged, they say, from identifying as a member of Opus Dei. But what do they do? Do they evangelise, Antonia? What is their main mission?
So Opus Dei was founded in 1928 by a young Spanish priest called José María Escrivá. Who is now a saint, exactly. Mm-hmm. And he said that he had an intuition or a vision from God that he needed to create this new family within the church to sort of be at the vanguard of, you know, Jesus' call that we are all a member of God's family and we should all be apostles. So, yeah, proselytism is a very strong part of Opus Dei and bringing other people into the family. And their mission is to be very committed Catholics,
but in the midst
of the world is the sort of the way that they put it. So their idea is that you don't have to, Escrivá's idea is that you don't have to go into a nunnery or become a monk to be a committed Catholic. You can go and have a job as a journalist, a banker, a doctor, a a clerk, a teacher, whatever you want, but still live your life to, you know, that kind of utmost Christian kind of attainment, which is a great idea.
Extraordinarily, extraordinarily noble and honourable.
Yeah, I think that, that you know, it's one of the great shames, and you know, that my the reporting does uncover is that how did that go so wrong?
And like, for an organisation, one that's so active in Ireland, two that professes what you've just said about the living the Christian life and being proud of the Christian life. It's amazing they won't come on Liveline. This is the statement they gave us. We are very sorry and deeply regret that Tina Fogarty and Anne-Marie Allen were hurt by their time in Opus Dei. We've been in contact with them now for some months and have offered to meet them in order to help resolve the various issues they have raised. We hope they will take up the offer soon. Do you know that Anne-Marie and Tina have refused to meet Opus Dei? Is that what they're saying?
I did know that Opus Dei have tried to contact them. I think saying we have been in contact with them for some months is a interesting way of portraying it. I think the trouble that Opus Dei don't seem to realise is that victims tend to not want to speak to the people they believe to be their abusers. So Opus Dei have contacted them, and they contacted them before the article came out, which I think many of my sources who were approached read as a pretty thinly veiled attempt to try and silence them before it was published.
Okay.
And they have, yeah, offered to meet to discuss or, you know, quote marks, resolve the issues. But these women do not want to meet with Opus Dei members who they find incredibly triggering and worry that they will try and subject them to the same sort of doublespeak that they had to face when they were actually members.
And what do you think of the phrase from the Irish? I'll go into the... Because the Opus Dei internationally were well able to supply a very, very articulate, and you heard her as well as I did on 7 o'clock on Sunday morning on BBC, articulate spokesperson. But the Dublin office, the Opus Dei, sorry, Irish office, say, I were deeply sorry regret that Tina Fogarty and Anne-Marie Allen were hurt by their time in Opus Dei. Does that adequately describe what happened to two women?
No, I don't think hurt covers it at all. I have spoken to several people who knew them at the time and knew what they were going through, and hurt definitely does not cover it. I mean, both women have had to have years and thousands of pounds of counselling since they left.
Wow.
When they left, you know, Tina, for example, she was 33 and she knew absolutely nothing of the world. It has completely shaped the rest of her life. And what she has been able to do with her life since. And, you know, she's an absolutely remarkable woman, and they both are. But the impact of having their childhoods taken away from them through behaviour that they were coerced into signing up to and not given the full picture of when they were 15 or 16, I don't think hurt quite covers that, no.
And then the phrase used on Sunday by the spokesperson was, from their rebuttal to your piece, Antonia, they say three women, obviously Anne-Marie and Tina, the two Irish women are the main two-thirds of that group, they say three women recount negative experiences.
Yeah, they, I mean, it should be said that I did contact some of the individuals mentioned my piece who were who worked in the Opus Dei centres in Ireland as numeraries, were directors of the centres, and they obviously strongly dispute account as I portrayed them. But Opus Dei, yeah, their response has tended to try and focus. They mentioned, you know, negative experiences due to their personal situation. But like I said earlier, the fact that this situation and these experiences were shared by so many people, and often, you know, the way they described them to me was similar down to the very same words or phrases across different countries. That to me is not a personal experience, it's an institutional problem.
Okay, and I'm very conscious as you speak. One, I'm very conscious that people might be afraid of coming forward, especially when they hear statements from Opus Dei. I'm sorry if they were hurt by their time in Opus Dei, because what Tina and Anne-Marie explained. By the way, let's remind people that we are talking about real relatively young people who were deeply affected and are trying to redress in many ways what went on. This is again the voice of Tina Fogarty.
I was expecting a school because it did say hospitality and catering. So I imagined it would cover all aspects of learning about how to work in hospitality industry. I knew there was an emphasis on religion, but I didn't know there were an organization per se. We had prayers and mass first, and then we went cleaning, cooking, more cleaning, cooking, laundry, and we had to prepare 3 meals a day plus other snacks and things like that for up to 100 people. I remember having cracked and broken hands again from the calluses and the welts, and the next day you start exactly the same, and it went on and on. Even after becoming an official member, I never received any payment at all. We got an allowance on request, £3 a month, for which you had to account for each penny and return any change that you might have had after buying your toiletries and your sanitary products. I knew there were numeries and assistant numeries, and I, in my naivety, thought that you could start as an assistant numerary and progress to numerary. They put me straight on that quite quickly when I questioned it. This is your vocation, and you can only be an assistant numerary, and your vocation is to serve.
Yeah, and numeries were invariably men, and we have supernumeraries, don't we, Antonia?
And they are all men. That's not quite true. No,
okay.
So Opus Dei members are about 50% men and women.
No, but it's just the supernumeraries are the priests, are they not?
The supernumeraries are the married members. The priests are ordained numeraries.
Okay.
So there are lots of numeraries and supernumeraries.
Okay, so there's 2,000 2,000 priests in Opus Dei.
Yes.
They're ordained numeraries. Supernumeraries,
exactly, yeah.
Supernumeraries can marry and live in their own homes.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah.
And they make up the majority of Opus Dei members, about 75% of them.
Okay. But when they of the marital couple, which one of them would have been the member of Opus Dei first, if you follow me?
It could be either. I think the thing where gender and sex is very important is that it was in an Opus Dei centre, whether it was a male centre or a female centre, it is only the women who were doing that domestic work.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Where they were doing it in a male centre, the men were not allowed to interact with them. They had to stare straight ahead as they served them food. So this domestic work was solely a role and is solely a role in the organisation that is for women.
So when the women like Tina and Anne-Marie, by the way, the ad was in the Irish Countrywoman magazine. That's where they advertised, and that was in 1979 that the women answered. You're saying when Tina and Anne-Marie were serving these men their dinner, after cooking the dinner, I presume, none of them could turn around and say, Tina, how are you keeping? Or how's the family back in Dublin or Limerick or whatever? Nothing.
No, nothing. Expressly in Opus Dei's internal guidelines from the time, it says, the perfect administration, which is the term they use to refer to the women doing the domestic work, is neither seen nor heard. That's a verbatim quote from their internal directives at the time.
They were neither seen nor heard. Now, in the statement that came from Rome, the headquarters of Opus Dei, which was a direct response to your article in the Financial Times, they say that everything has changed. The assistant numeraries are paid. They follow the Opus Dei tradition. It's followed. The vocation of assistant numeraries is followed by thousands of women. No men mentioned. Mm. This is their statement as of last week. Around the world with freedom, love and commitment. And it's the same dignity as any other life choice. In fact, many women who joyfully lived this vocational call made a public plea a few months ago for their free and conscious choice to be respected and not undervalued. Was this in response to what was coming down the line, I wonder?
Yeah, so I think it is important to say that, you know, if someone makes a choice of their own free will and their own free volition as a consenting adult to be an assistant numerary, and then they are paid and put in social security for that role, that is, you know, that is not an issue. That's their own choice. But it's not quite true to say that it has all changed. I have spoken to, you know, I spoke to 16 former assistant numeraries. Only sort of a handful of those were from the UK and Ireland. Many of them are from other countries in Europe, the US, Latin America. And like I say, many of those women left much more recently than Anne-Marie and Tina did. And, you know, the person I spoke to who left most recently, it was in, she left in 2020. She had been working for 34 years and was never paid a dime. So it hasn't changed everywhere.
Okay, I just want to get Alison in, who's listening to you, Antonia. Alison, good afternoon.
Hello there, Joe.
What does this bring up for you, Alison?
Okay, nothing terrible or bad.
Okay, good.
When I was 15, my dad had died. My mum was widowed. There were only the two of us in the house. She was feeling lonely, and a friend said, I know where you could take in students for the summer. There's a Glenard University residence in Roebuck. And
okay,
they have
in Dublin, yeah.
students coming in to learn English, yeah.
Yeah.
And the ones they can't accommodate themselves in what university residence during the academic year, they put out into families.
Okay.
And so we had... two girls, Adine from France and Carmen from Spain, and they stayed with us, and they went over to Glenard every day for class, but I was encouraged to go over as well, for not for class, but for other things. And there were, let's say, quiet ways of trying to get me involved. Mm-hmm. There were, you know, religious things. You'd be told to come along to, I've forgotten what they called it,
a circle,
where a lay person would stand up and kind of preach. And then because of my connection with for 2 years, I was invited to go. I had the opportunity to go to Rome at Easter with some members.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I remember, that this hospitality bit really brought it back to me. We stayed in something that was called a Scuola Alberiera something or other, S-A something.
Okay.
And that has to have been, you know, a training school for the serving staff of Opus Dei. And we stayed in this residence for Easter week.
Mm-hmm.
And we had beautiful meals. The place was lovely.
Course,
the bedrooms were Spartan.
Yeah, great.
There was mass early every morning. We went out on visiting trips. I actually met the founder in a group of about 20
Escriva,
people.
Escriva, Jose Escriva, who's now a saint.
Yeah. Now, I didn't have an appreciation of that.
Okay.
I really didn't. I still don't, if you know what I mean.
And were you aware of this, that this, the place in Rome was a hospitality training school? And did you feel, and only say what you want to say, Alison, did you feel under any pressure to join?
They were putting me under pressure, which my mum could sense. And I came home with a book called The Work.
Okay.
And, you know, I lost it, but I didn't know it later. She burnt it. I didn't lose it. She burnt it. But what I can remember, if I, probably the most pertinent bit of this was, after the day where a Chinese person interpreted for the Irish and the Austrian in the language of Spanish, because Jose Escriva only spoke Spanish.
Spanish, yes.
And we were in, it was interpreted what his message was, and some of it was girls in short skirts, and you shouldn't be in short skirts. But when I went back, I was younger. I was only, say, 16, and the members that I went with were all adults. And as a 16-year-old, I had more in common with the staff in the place, the serving staff.
Of course, yeah.
Because I was more their age. And they were asking me and hanging on every word, what did the Monsignor say and tell me and what and so on. And just because I, languages aren't difficult for me and I could actually make myself understood in Pidgin Italian. But they were, there was a way that they tried to make everything nice and lovely and homely and welcome, whether it was in Glenard or in Dublin.
Okay, there's another story after the break. But Alison, why did your mother dispose of the book, The Work, that you came home with from Opus Dei?
Yeah, well, something that happened or didn't happen in the school in Rome, one of the members that I can only describe as a bit masculine. I'm not going to say any more than that, right? We were all ladies. She was a bit masculine. And she used to invite me to her room at night for chats. Mm-hmm. And it was totally chats.
Okay, I
but
understand.
My mum didn't like the whole connotation and didn't like it. And was this, you know, them trying to rope me in? And I was offered places for studying in the winter time and, you know, getting grinds and God knows what else. They tried various ways of getting me involved.
Okay.
And between me having a strong will and my mother being strong,
okay,
I never did.
What I if you can, I don't know if you came across the article in the Financial Times, Alison.
I didn't, but I'd love to read it.
Oh, it's superb. It's superb, and it's a long piece now. And the Financial Times, understandably, is behind the paywall. But we'll try and through Antonia, especially as I can see by the screens here, we're getting a lot of interest in this. We try and make it available in greater numbers to our Irish listeners. Alison, thanks. And I know you're saying to us, can we pass on your contact details to Antony. We will do with your permission. Yeah, we will do with your permission. Okay, Alison, thanks. More after
Thank
this break.
So much,
Joe at rt.ie, 51551 text.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
A very serious piece, as always, but a very unusual piece in many ways for the Financial Times. Now, I know I only get it on a Saturday, but and I know you do lots of investigation, but it's about Opus Dei and the position of assistant numeraries. And there were adverts that appeared in the Irish Countrywoman's magazine in the 1970s, and they were for hospitality schools. And they didn't mention Opus Dei, but it turned out to wear Opus Dei. Deirdre, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. You left home at what age, Deirdre?
17 to go to college in Dublin from rural Ireland.
Okay.
And I went to a hostel which was Opus Dei.
Yeah. Well, and they had one there in Hume Street in Dublin, a fairly big one. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, okay. And
What I've been driving, and I just heard your program about the girls doing the catering.
The assistant numeraries.
Yes, they would have been serving us our meals, but we weren't allowed to interact with them in any way or talk to them. And it was quite strict. We would have had to wear a skirt in the dining room at all times, and we would have been encouraged to watch films in the evenings in the sitting room called The Work.
Okay, The Work.
And, The Work was the name of it. And if you wanted to go home at weekends, you had to have a letter of permission written in by your parents.
This was 1983.
83, yeah, correct.
Credit.
Yeah.
And you, as a third level student, weren't allowed in this hostel, which your family were paying for, I presume.
Correct,
You were not allowed to talk to the young women, maybe of the same age, who were serving you food.
Yes, that was the rule.
And what was but if that was the rule, what was the penalty?
Well, I don't know. You just didn't do it.
It was observed.
Yes.
Could you have guests, overnight guests?
Oh, no. You shared a room with other people, and there was somebody from Opus, an Opus Dei member in each bedroom.
Oh, and
I remember being quite shocked because I was in a room with four other people.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect that. It was quite expensive. I remember at the time it was about £700 for the term.
Okay. And how long did you stay there?
I ran away at Christmas.
Okay.
I packed a bag and ran. I know it sounds funny, but
why did you run away?
I was afraid, and I didn't want to get into a confrontation by telling them I was leaving. So a friend was with me, waiting for me on the doorstep, and
we ran down
the road. And then I had to go back after Christmas and get the rest of my stuff, and I was interrogated as to why I wouldn't stay. And you know, I felt lucky that I actually got out of there because I felt I could have been sucked in.
Yeah.
And what worried me...
And did you tell... Deirdre, did you tell your parents?
I suppose I didn't want to upset them. I told them when I got home at Christmas.
And Deirdre, looking back on it now, and it's relatively recently, this is Dublin in the 1980s, not the 1950s, what are your memories of those women, those young women who were serving you food who you weren't allowed to even say hello to?
Well, I felt very sorry for them and I felt it was very wrong.
And you'd no idea where they were from.
I remember some were from Spain.
Okay.
And some were from other parts of Ireland.
Yeah, and then some Irish, I'm sure, would have been sent to Spain and Mexico and Argentina, whatever. Okay, so the story that Antonia, well, Tina and Anne Marie's story that Antonia is telling, and we heard Tina's voice earlier on. That's resonating for you, and I'm thinking of those women. Okay, Deirdre, thanks indeed. Teresa Boylan, sorry for keeping you there, Teresa. What's your story, Reopus Day? The year is 1979. The Pope John Paul comes to Ireland. Outpourings of joy and great fervour, as one newspaper put it. Biggest event since Catholic Emancipation, the Eucharistic Congress, and the biggest event ever in Irish Catholic Church because the visit of Pope Francis in 2017 was a complete and total damp squib in comparison to 1979. Tell us what happened to you, Teresa, in 79.
Okay, briefly.
Yeah.
It was 1979 and I was on the bus going back to Dublin.
Okay.
I worked in the bank, you know, young really. And on that place in Navan, outside Navan, there's something house that they owned. This woman got on the bus and she was a very good-looking lady, Spanish, sat down beside me, started chatting, told me all about what she was doing. Before she even got off the bus, she was handing me holy pictures of the Spanish priest that just called this and advised me to bring them into my friends.
That's creepy, yeah.
I didn't do that. But anyway, she invited me out to their residence out in Milltown in Richmond Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Probably know there. For tea one day, Thursday afternoon, and I naively went. So when I went out, and then she met me and brought into this room, table and chairs, and she left. So she's gone ages, and I'm thinking, I'm going to get the tea and biscuits, no? So she comes back in, sits down again, and we charming. Tell me all about the members of your family, what do they work at?
Okay.
And all that.
And what do you think they were trying to do, Teresa? I'm stuck for time. What do you think they were trying to do?
To try and find out if we had money in the family.
Okay.
I'd say I tried to lure them all in.
And you posted letters for the girls who were there.
Yeah. And I came out and the lady came out with me. And out of nowhere, these two young girls jumped out. So I was somewhere and this girl has an envelope in her hand. I said, please, can you post that for me?
Okay.
And of course, the lady couldn't say anything and I said, I will. But the two little ones looked terrified.
Oh, my God. Okay, Teresa, stay there. I'm just stuck for time. John Brennan. John, I know you've been on before and you're a great talker. You're well able to get across your message in a minute because you were running a sweet shop in Milltown in Dublin, which has just been mentioned. John.
Yeah, the sweet shop in Milltown was just up the road from Nunnamore University residence.
Okay.
And once a week, a group of young ladies used to come into the shop and buy sweets. Now, they were far too old to be buying sweets. And they were totally supervised on their widows.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were from Cromston Catering. They were the girls that served in Nullamore. And one of them told me that they got paid very small money for what they did. And they weren't allowed to speak at all to the boys because it was a male residence.
And this was the 1970s?
1970s, yeah, yeah. I can still
see
them.
Where do you think all these young women who weren't allowed to speak, where were they from?
They were all from parts of rural Ireland.
Okay.
And I thought they all struck me as vulnerable, if you understand what I mean.
And they all would have seen the ad, and the Irish Country Women Association, which didn't mention Opus Dei. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Antonia Cundy, thank you so much for participating. I suspect we're going to be hearing a lot more. Have you got much reaction to your piece?
Yes, I have. Yeah, I've had lots of reaction. People from all over the world getting in touch. And it's really striking to hear those callers.
And
what they're describing is so familiar.
Yeah, and there's more to come, Antonia. But above all, as you are, I'm thinking of Tina Fogarty today. I'm thinking of Anne-Marie Allen. And I'm thinking of Monica in Buenos Aires, who was your third participant, third very, very brave and courageous woman who participated in your preparation of that article, which is in the Financial Times. And we'll find a way of getting it accessible to more people. Hilary Jones produced. Ray Darcy is next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in-store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.